Part 1. Prologue. Chapter 1.
Everyone thinks this story ended tragically, and everyone is wrong. I was there, and as far as I'm concerned, the only tragic part of this story was the middle. The extinction of life on Earth began when my girlfriend asked me to roofie her. We were sitting on my bed, binge-watching The Handmaid's Tale, when Betty handed me a red pill.
Slip this into my drink. It will destroy my will to resist you. And tomorrow, I won't remember what you did to me.
I looked at the pill and imagined policemen frog-marching me to jail. Why not just take it yourself?
Don't be ridiculous. It's way more fun if you do it to me. Tonight, we're going to try something so disgusting that if I don't enjoy it, I won't want the foul memory in my brain.
I accepted the pill. I assume you want something specific?
Yes, and tomorrow, I'll ask you if I enjoyed it. If I did, we can do it again. If I didn't, I won't have to remember.
That's when the police knocked on my door, which sounds bad, and in fact it was bad. But at the time, I was just grateful they didn't arrive 30 minutes later. I did not enjoy the next 4 months because the police had knocked on my door for a reason, and it wasn't to ask me for advice on doing their job better. As it turned out, the next 4 months were not merely unpleasant, they were also boring, so I won't detail them, except to say they ended with me sitting in a courtroom with my lawyer in agony. He was miserable because he hadn't been able to mention his Princeton law degree for nearly 2 hours. At last, it was his turn to talk. Cruelly, my lawyer only made it as far as,
"When I was studying law at..."
When the courtroom door burst open and a cop charged in, heading straight for the judge. An alert bailiff spotted the danger and waddled forward as nimbly as a supertanker intercepting a torpedo. However, just when she had built up some momentum, her thighs collided, and she couldn't get her next foot out in front. She rolled forward onto the floor, like a hippopotamus who'd tried to vault a fence, and almost cleared the top rail. On her way down, she said a word that was inappropriate to a courtroom. To her credit, she had managed to block the cop's path. He considered stepping over her, but the bailiff was fundamentally round. When she tipped over, her height hadn't changed much, so he walked around her and handed a note to the bemused judge. The judge resembled the bailiff, except pear-shaped for stability on her judge bench. Note, her judge bench was a $5,700 doe-skin chair. She read the note and glared at the cop.
"If this is a joke, you'll be inspecting gay bathhouses for a year."
The cop didn't answer, but I swear his hand twitched toward his gun.
"1 hour recess."
The judge banged her gavel, then peered at the bailiff, who at this point was supposed to say, "All rise," but instead was lying on the floor, making a noise that reminded me of sea lions as she clutched at her knee, which she couldn't quite reach. The cop sighed.
"I'll rise for the judge."
The courtroom crowd was sparse, as my case was serious but routine, a third offense for improving my house without a permit. This time they got me for building a backyard deck. Did you ever wonder who paid for all those private Earth observation satellite launches? A big chunk were hired out to city governments for code and permit surveillance. I learned the hard way. We all stood up while the judge swished out. When the door closed behind her, my lawyer tried again.
"When I was at Princeton, we..."
But he was interrupted by the cop, who said,
"Earth was just surrounded by 1,000 giant alien spaceships."
Everyone ran outside to look, except I hung around to chat with the cop, since I was shackled to my chair on account of some entirely reasonable statements I had made during my trial. The cop told me he was quitting his job, as he had finally saved enough money to retire to a Louisiana trailer community and smoke meth full-time. On his last day as a cop, he was finally living his dream. He had spent the morning arresting every member of the city council for solicitation of prostitution, based on their campaign promises. The note he had passed the judge said her house was on fire, and could she please ask her neighbors to stop shooting at the firemen? As pranks go, This one seemed benevolent, since it would make her so happy when she found out it wasn't true. I never saw that judge again. Three days later, my trial was still in recess because no judges were willing to leave their televisions. It turned out we had not been surrounded by 1,000 spaceships. There were only 982, all spherical, which the TV pundits said was sensible. For the same reason, soap bubbles are spherical, because it minimizes the amount of skin required to cover a given interior volume. Personally, I thought round spaceships were stupid for the same reason dome houses are stupid. The convenient interior space is rectangular. I later found out I was wrong about that. The spaceship diameters ranged from 80 up to 480 yards, which the American science pundits mentioned with a patronizing smile after they reported the size in the far more sensible metric units they pretended to prefer while a camera was watching. We had time to discuss these issues because the globular ships just quietly orbited the Earth, not communicating or doing anything interesting until the third day, when they did something interesting. I was watching the news when it happened. The network switched to a reporter standing earnestly outside the White House.
"We have breaking news that one of the alien spheres has launched a projectile aimed at,
He looked at someone off camera.
"Seriously? It's aimed here?"
Then he said a bad word. 10 minutes later, he updated us with news the U.S. military had fired a barrage of Patriot missiles at the incoming projectile, which promptly disappeared from radar long before it was intercepted.
"Maybe it gave up and self-destructed,"
the reporter standing at ground zero said hopefully, as he was encircled by a variety of armored vehicles, bristling with 30-millimeter cannons pointed upward. 4 minutes after that, the reporter looked up and said another word that will be omitted from this history. The camera panned up to the sky and zoomed into a giant orange and white frowny face. It was a round parachute, dangling something shaped sensibly rectangular. Eventually, the dishwasher-sized box landed gently in a ring of soldiers and reporters pointing guns and cameras at it. The frowny face parachute snapped free and drifted away on the breeze until it wrapped around a camera truck. Everyone watched nervously, except some news guys who swore a lot while they tried to pull the parachute off their satellite dish. The thin shroud lines had tangled up with their antennas. The alien dishwasher flipped open a hatch on top, and a flagpole telescoped up with a whirring noise. It reached a height of 5 feet, whereupon, with a faint clunk, the top foot of the pole bent itself sideways, levering over to the horizontal and extruding a banner printed with the first communication from an alien race, perfectly framed in the cameras with the U.S. Capitol in the background. Then the machine helpfully read the message aloud. It said,
"I could have been a bomb that killed everyone in this city. The other humans wouldn't miss you. Seriously, they wouldn't, we can tell."
I began to feel a sense of cautious optimism. At my wise old age of 22, I should have known better. The next day, we received our second-ever message from an alien race. I was eating a bean burrito and watching the news, where an excellently groomed male reporter was man on the street interviewing a cocktail waitress, asking her how the alien star drive worked. The waitress was just starting to explain the mathematics of interstellar travel when her image was replaced by a two-layer octopus. A cylinder like a fire plug with rings of mechanical tentacles around the top and bottom. Its metal tentacles were tipped with pincers, except one sported a corkscrew. One tentacle held a chrome microphone while another snaked out and tapped the mic twice. Then the robotic machine uttered the second ever communication from an alien race, which was,
"Is this thing on?"
Another historic moment. I dropped my burrito into Spike's cage and gave the aliens my full attention. Spike was my vicious pit bull who had been the night watchman for a pawn shop in the worst part of town. Spike had been trained to attack everyone except his owner, who had choked to death on a prostitute. After that, Spike attacked everyone, so he stayed in a cage and bit the stick I used to scrape out the poop. I had adopted him because I was sure I could find a hilarious use for him. He savaged the burrito while I watched the robot on television.
"Let's cut to the chase,"
the alien machine announced.
"We're here to kidnap 32,768 humans to use for slave labor. In truth, we don't know exactly how many slaves we will need, so we just picked a round number. You may choose which slaves we take, but they must be age 19 to 25, unmarried, childless, but fertile in good health with IQ above 125 and 50% female. The men must be able to bench press their own weight, and the women must be able to do 2 chin-ups, clean chin-ups, no leg flailing."
I felt a dark premonition. My IQ is well north of 125, so I had already puzzled out what kind of people our government would choose for sacrifice.
"You have 2 weeks to assemble our slaves in the U.S. Capitol Mall. When you refuse, which we know you will destroy Kampala. That's a city in Uganda you don't care about. We were afraid if we threatened an important city, you would give in too soon. It's been a tough year for us, and we're in the mood to blow something up."
The image switched back to the cocktail waitress. She was still explaining physics and had covered a menu chalkboard with equations, apparently unaware her channel had been hijacked. I wondered how the aliens would destroy the Ugandan city. Would they hit it with a beam weapon that dissolved molecular bonds and collapsed all matter into dust? Or maybe they'd unleash Godzilla to grind the place down one photogenic footprint at a time. While I was contemplating that question, my phone rang. It was Betty, my girlfriend.
"They are obviously taking you, so I'm breaking up with you. Can I have your stereo?"
Yeah, that's how predictable this was. 12 days later, the combined forces of NATO launched an alpha strike on the alien fleet, firing a salvo of 2,459 hastily modified ICBMs, the only weapons capable of reaching the aliens' 400-mile orbit. The Chinese and Russians did not participate. The Chinese government didn't refuse to participate. They just stopped answering their phones until it was over, then denied it. The Russians said the attack was pointless theater to placate neurotic Western women. Western women responded with a social media torrent that was widely judged to have proved the Russian theory. The aliens saw the missiles coming and eased out to 600 miles. All of the ICBMs petered out into elliptical orbits, with apogees of 420 to 550 miles, and perigees inside the Earth's mantle. Red-faced generals assured us the nukes would not explode when they impacted the surface, and there was an excellent chance their plutonium cores would not be powdered and scattered around a crowded city. I never did find out if that was true, because the trajectories had been designed to ensure any missiles that missed their targets would land in Russia. Two days later, all of Earth's news reporters watched the partially evacuated Ugandan capital, Kampala, from a distance of 5,000 to 12,000 miles, and pretended they didn't want the city to explode. I had wondered how the aliens would destroy the Ugandan city. Would they erase it instantly with a beam weapon? Or would they crush it slowly, with hours of excellent video opportunities, by releasing Godzilla? No, nothing so exotic. They just released a lot of energy in a small space. The flash and the expanding shockwave looked beautiful from orbit. Beyond that, I never learned the technical details of the attack, because there was only so much network broadcast time, and every politician needed some of it to tell us how much he cared about the victims. They also took some time to bluster about the evil of slavery, as if they actually believed the alien robots wanted human slaves. I didn't believe it because I am not a complete idiot. Compared to a robot, a human requires 100 times the maintenance and works only 1 hour in three. A robot owning a human slave is like an accountant hiring a stripper to balance his checkbook. He must have an ulterior motive. Whatever their motive, it must be urgent, because a 982-ship robot fleet had flown a colossal distance and was now sitting idle, at staggering expense, just to grab a few humans and make enemies of the rest of us. I thought something large must be afoot, and I was right. The morning after the attack on Kampala, the UN convened an emergency session and voted 192-1 that the United States would provide 28,000 of the 32,768 human slaves. That afternoon, the president addressed the nation.
In this dark time, Americans must do our share, and our share is 85%. Let me assure you that all of the American volunteers will be convicted criminals. Some will say, I chose criminals to favor a particular party. Let me assure you, that was not the case. In times like this, we are not Republicans or Democrats. We are Americans. We rise above partisan politics, which is why I have just signed an executive order to ensure all of the American volunteers, 100%, are registered libertarians.
The next morning, a squad of police kicked open my door to help me volunteer. I had already dragged my runaway rucksack out of the attic and thrown my stereo into my hot tub. The day before, a bunch of rainbow-haired hippies had marched through downtown, protesting our failed attack on the aliens, which gave me a chance to get rid of Spike. The last time I saw him, he was bounding joyously toward a crowd of men wearing tie-dye dresses and waving signs that said, "Give peace a chance." I hadn't needed my genius IQ to know the police would come for me. The U.S. president had promised he would hand over only criminals, and there aren't many convicted criminals with IQ above 125 who aren't also major campaign donors. Plus, I had no real family because my parents changed their names and pretended they didn't know me. Worst of all, my criminal offenses had been of the failed to obtain a permit variety, which marked me as having a bad attitude. My runaway ruck was packed with gear I expected to need in an emergency, including dry socks, 6 dozen condoms, and a Vietnamese hand grenade. My grandfather once told me, "If your socks are dry, you have most of what you need." Grandpa had brought the Vietnamese hand grenade home from the war in 1973, and it instantly became a family heirloom the women didn't know about. It was so old that it probably didn't work anymore, but I could think of only one way to test it, and after that, the test results wouldn't really be useful. I kept it in my runaway ruck so the cops could have something to confiscate. Cops can't relax until they've seized something I own. They seized the whole rucksack, so I spent the next 18 days without it, living in a tent on the Capitol Mall, watching the volunteers roll in by the thousands, surrounded by a black steel security fence originally purchased by our elected representatives to stop us from killing them. My tent was the military canvas kind with a center pole and 4 cots. I was first to arrive, so I claimed the cot furthest from the door. If you've ever lived in a tent, you know why you want that one. I had just finished short-sheeting the other cots when a tall, muscular blonde guy opened the flap and peered in. If you don't know what short-sheet means, ask your dad. He will enjoy explaining it. The newcomer was named Dudley. At the time, he had a different name, but dead naming him would be pointless. We were leaving our old lives behind, so we gave each other new names that suited us, like single mothers beginning our new careers as exotic dancers. Dudley looked like a recruiting poster for the Third Reich. 6 feet tall, blonde, handsome, and muscular. He glanced around the tent, taking in the four cots.
Which bed should I avoid?
I pointed to the cot closest to the door. That guy will be woken up by everyone who goes in or out, and the floor there will always be dirty. When you walk in and shake the rain off your jacket, you'll shake it onto him. Dudley tossed his suitcase onto the bad cot, the one closest to the door, which was my first clue to his weirdness. The next man to arrive was Cynic, though I hadn't named him that yet. A tanned face peeked into the tent and winced.
The government must be trying to wean us off luxuries like plumbing.
I said, nice tan.
Thanks. The government told us to avoid the sun, so sunlight must be good for us.
Cynic was the smallest of us, at 5 feet 8 inches and 170 pounds, just 20 years old. I asked him what he'd done to get sent here.
I stupidly majored in chemistry,
he groused as he tossed his duffel onto a cot.
That's why I got tapped for alien slavery, because Washington is controlled by a cabal of environmentalists. They want to get rid of anyone who actually understands pollution.
I thought he was wrong about that. Like all of us, Cynic was a libertarian, and the government looked at libertarians the same way roaches looked at exterminators. The last to arrive was Eeyore. He opened the tent flap, took in the cots, and sighed heavily.
It figures.
Eeyore was the same height as me, 5 feet 10 inches with a paunch, and his life had been tragic.
I grew up in an upper-class family,
he lamented as we all walked to the chow tent.
I wasn't poor enough to qualify as a victim, but I also wasn't rich enough to tell my dates we'd be having sex before dinner. Us people in the middle are always the ones who get screwed, and I get screwed the hardest, but not in the good way. I'm cursed.
Dudley and Cynic poo-pooed his theory, but I was more compassionate, so I affirmed his lived experience. I think you're on to something. I've known four guys who believed they were cursed, and they were all correct. Everyone laughed at my friend Mike, but they stopped laughing when a Special Olympics bus veered off the road at 2 a.m. and rammed his bedroom. Eeyore looked horrified.
He was killed in his bed by a Special Olympics bus?
No, it didn't kill him. In fact, it actually made him eligible for the Special Olympics. Would you mind terribly taking the cot farthest from me? The curse story was not strictly true, or loosely true, but the important thing was that Eeyore felt validated in his feelings. Our first dinner together was canned mackerel casserole, which brought the conversation around to the subject of choking.
Girls love it,
Cynic assured us. Eeyore leaned forward.
Really?
He seemed intrigued.
She likes to say we're equally yoked, but a girl just wants to be choked and poked.
Dudley was not impressed.
My girlfriend is a Christian. She does not care to be choked or poked.
That's the kind of girl who likes me best, I chimed in with my mouth full of mackerel and only one small bone. But don't worry, I accept my solemn duty to send her back to you smiling. My tent mates named me Prick, though I don't know why. Probably I'd poked myself with a thorn I don't remember. Dudley didn't know I had named him after a cartoon buffoon, Dudley Do-Right, and I never had the heart to tell him. He was saving himself for marriage, so I spent the rest of dinner time telling him the details of hot girls I'd banged, and how much I respected him for never giving in to that temptation. He kind of squinched his mouth like he had bitten a lemon. Naturally, our camp had no actual girls. One thing all politicians agreed on is they wanted libertarians to be unhappy. The president called this place the Volunteer Emigrant Orientation Facility, so I took the time to meet every incoming load of volunteers. As they walked down the steps of the voluntary transportation bus and had their shackles removed, I greeted each new arrival with a cheerful, "Welcome to Camp Septic," and pretty soon the name caught on. It was the only way I could reach the president who had sent me here. reporters would latch onto the name Camp Septic, and the president would have to explain it. The new arrivals were our only source of news, because the only other people we could speak with were news reporters. We were fenced in by wire mesh, topped with concertina, so we could see the reporters outside pointing cameras at us, asking for interviews. Whenever I had time, which was almost always, I showed them my hairy ass. Our tent was the military canvas type, and it stayed clean because Dudley quietly cleaned it. When I caught him tidying up Cynic's cot, I asked him why. He shrugged.
Do you have something better to do?
I had expected him to say something pompously Christian, like, it's a blessing to serve. But Dudley wasn't that kind of Christian. He was the other kind, who just did stuff without talking about it. The first night we played nuclear spades and talked about our lives. Cynic explained that he was between girlfriends.
My last girlfriend, Cindy, accused me of ogling her best friend. She lectured me for an hour while I apologized. But then 2 days later, she broke up with me by text.
You shouldn't gaze lustfully at any girl,
said Dudley.
That's disrespectful.
Ah, Dudley, how could we not love you? I picked up my cards. It sounds like she was testing you and you failed. That kind of test has a name, but it's one of the words I am omitting from this history.
Of course.
Cynic nodded and fanned open his cards.
I decided to fail. She was getting annoying, but if I broke up with her, then the girl code would force her friends to shun me.
Wait, said Eeyore. Are you saying you wanted to bang the girl you apologized for ogling?
No, I was already banging her other best friend. Cindy was a hot, mean girl with hot, mean girlfriends who loved the idea of sleeping with her boyfriend. I'll hook you up with her if you like. You'll need a thick skin, but it's worth it for access to her hot friends who want to betray her.
Eeyore seemed confused.
You deliberately simped to make Cindy break up with you because you wanted to keep banging her best friend.
In nuclear spades, at least one person on each team must go nil. That guy needs his partner to have high cards to cover him. I looked at my cards and realized I had the best nil hand I had ever seen. You screwed up. You should have dumped her if you wanted to attract her friends. That's how women think.
No, you're thinking of nice girls. Cindy's clique follows the mean girl code. You can boink your best friend's boyfriend, and you can keep boinking him if she dumps him. But boys are not allowed to dump a mean girl, so if one of them does it, all the mean girls must stand together and shun him.
Dudley seemed disgusted.
If the Apostle Paul had known you, he would have written you a letter.
I checked my cards and confirmed I had no spades and nothing higher than a 7, so there was zero chance I could take a trick. I bid 1.
Just my luck.
Eeyore was my partner, so now he had to go nil, which meant he could not take any tricks. Me bidding 1 was the worst-case scenario for him, since it forced him to go nil, and also meant my cards weren't high enough to cover him. He would probably take a trick and lose 100 points. As it happened, he took 11 of the 13 tricks, since he had 3 aces and all the high spades. I took 0, of course, since I had the best nil hand I had ever seen. So I'm sure you'll agree that forcing my partner to go nil instead was hilarious. That kind of story was worth 10 victories. The next day, a new fad swept through the camp. Jumping off the tops of the various statues and walls around the mall. But it lost most of its appeal when we found out a broken bone didn't get us sent home. On day 5, some geeks in white lab coats administered the bench press test. When it was my turn, a skinny guy stuck 2 electrodes on my pecs.
How much do you weigh?
I said, 240 pounds. He glanced at something behind me, then loaded the bench press with 210 pounds, which by coincidence was my actual body weight. I struggled to raise the bar, but I just couldn't do it. The skinny guy consulted an alien-looking machine and said,
"He's faking. He can do it."
Drat. hundreds of men successfully failed the bench press test. As they marched out in disgrace, they waved at us and shouted various versions of, "Ha ha, you think you're so fit and healthy. Now who do you think will live longer?" Eeyore moaned.
"Figures I'd pass. Nothing good ever happens to me."
The test was rigged to exempt men with political connections. The guys who failed probably sent a pile of cash to the president's Cayman bank account.
I looked surprised. "Wait, you guys wanted to fail? To fail the test, you just had to hold your breath for 30 seconds. I thought everyone knew that." Cynic and Eeyore looked aghast. "Don't feel sorry for them. By that time, they should have wised up and stopped falling for simple pranks." Then Dudley chimed in his perfect Dudley style.
"It's an honor to be chosen. The Lord gives his toughest tests to the best souls. Not that I'm a good soul. I'm probably here as part of your test."
The weaklings who failed the bench press test must have complained publicly about the camp conditions, because the next day, a convoy of army trucks rolled in loaded with treasure. 50 pallets of Frito-Lay assortment packs, and 140 televisions. All of the TVs were locked on the home shopping network. I later learned the TVs in the women's camp were tuned to the fishing channel. One night after dinner, Salisbury steak that arrived in 55-gallon barrels labeled experimental, the four of us sat around the tent playing nuclear spades, and we had the "what are you in for" talk. The president had promised to volunteer only convicted criminals. Eeyore told us his dad had given him a new Corvette, in the same tone one would use to say, "My dad gave me monkeypox."
"I drove it to Colorado where weed was legal, and I was driving back home to Montana where it was also legal. But my route passed through Wyoming where weed was not legal. A month later, they auctioned off my $90,000 Corvette for $62,000.
"The mayor probably drove it for that month,"
Cynic declared.
"Some towns get most of their budget from civil asset forfeiture."
"What else could they do?"
said Dudley.
"Drugs are a scourge. Cynic, what was your crime?"
Cynic shuffled the deck.
"Do not date an accountant. When I broke up with her, she sent the IRS a 46-page report on my finances."
He offered me the deck.
"She listed the highlights as bullet points on the cover sheet."
I cut the deck back to Cynic. Then I confessed my two convictions for improving my house without a permit. Cynic passed out the cards.
"How about you, Dudley?"
Dudley averted his eyes.
"Murder."
"Yikes. Details, please."
"The guy was abusing a woman. I aimed for his nose, but hit his neck. Thank the Lord I was still a juvenile."
Cynic seemed surprised.
"Really? They unsealed your juvie record?"
"They must have. My only adult crime was storing rainwater without a permit. They wouldn't send me here for that."
Dudley was so sweetly naive. We later found out everyone in the camp, all 14,000 of us, had been busted for drugs, tax evasion, or permit violations. Cynic had a theory about that.
"The president didn't send any real criminals because he didn't want to lose his voters."
Personally, I thought the president did it because it was hilarious to send libertarians into slavery for crimes they didn't think were crimes. The West Wing staffers would be laughing about that for weeks. It turned out that, unlike us, the 14,000 girls were not all criminals, because the president had relaxed his criteria for women. The aliens had demanded single females under age 25, with an IQ above 125, who could do 2 chin-ups. The president wanted to send only registered libertarians with criminal records, but those all turned out to be girls busted for drugs and shoplifting, a trait they shared with the First Lady, so she made him cancel the criminal requirement. In the end, he just rounded up every unmarried female college student who had registered libertarian and could plausibly do 2 chin-ups. There were 28 of those in the United States. To collect the other 13,972, he removed the libertarian requirement and set up a website for women to nominate their friends to be exiled into alien slavery. The website immediately overloaded and crashed. They added some servers and got it back online, but promptly shut it down again when the news reported the website was accepting nominations from men. Oddly, men defied the predictions by mostly nominating their current girlfriends. Eventually, the nomination website figured out how to exclude males. Then it reopened for 6 minutes before it shut down for good, having collected 77,000 nominations for the 14,000 slots. 77,000 was 5.5 nominations for each slot, which was perfect. The president got to choose who would be sent into slavery while claiming they had been chosen by American women. Everyone congratulated the president for solving the problem, including us. We cheered for his solution and also for gracious American women who, out of concern for our well-being, had only nominated girls who were at least innate. The girls weren't libertarians, but all of us men were, which explained why Camp Septic was so tranquil. Ironically, anti-government libertarians were the most peaceful male demographic, even more docile than evangelical Christians. That was why libertarians had never controlled a country, and also why the Camp Septic guards never had to venture inside the fence where I could reach them. Since I couldn't punish the guards, I infiltrated the cooking crew by offering to do favors in return for extra helpings of chicken nuggets, which arrived in 50-pound bags labeled Not For Sale in the United States.
Those chicken nuggets must be contaminated with heavy metals,
Cynic said darkly. I think the manufacturer had sold them cheap because the nugget stamping machine had malfunctioned. The nuggets were supposed to be shaped like four-sided snowflakes, but instead they came out as little swastikas. I wish I could have witnessed the meeting where the production manager explained that to the CEO. I volunteered for all the worst food jobs and helped out so cheerfully that by day 8, the head chef was letting me write his inventory reports. I wonder how long it took before anyone actually read my reports and discovered the head chef had apparently been stealing everything that costs more than $3 per pound. The cooking crew ate separately from the volunteers, and they never realized their own meals tasted so bad because I had seasoned them with ground-up urinal cakes from the porta-potties. My other hobby was the same as everyone else's hobby, obsessively speculating about what the aliens wanted us for. The most popular theory was breeding farm.
They want us for some other kind of farm,
Eeyore predicted, which kept Cynic up all night worrying. We teased Dudley about his nightly prayers, but we only teased him once. One evening when Dudley got down on his knees, Cynic said,
Ask Santa Claus to bring me an Xbox.
That made Eeyore nervous, because everything made Eeyore nervous.
Hey, be nice. We all have to get along.
But Dudley did not want to be defended.
Go ahead and mock me. I want you to feel smugly superior, as you tell me you'll do the right thing without believing in God.
Okay, I will do the right thing without hallucinating an imaginary deity.
Dudley nodded approvingly.
Excellent. I hope you live up to that when real bullets start flying, and they can only be stopped by a heroic charge that half of us won't survive.
Eeyore looked horrified. Dudley knelt before his cot and folded his hands on his blanket. All of our blankets were made of an oddly stiff fabric, printed with a label that read, This side toward engine.
Cynic, when I say, watch this, Jesus, and charge into gunfire, will you join me? Or will you cower in your foxhole and let me take the bullets? Because that is the rational strategy.
You think the aliens will use us for cannon fodder? Now, who's the cynic?
Since you're the rational one, you'll need your Christian neighbors to charge the enemy guns. Because you sure won't do it.
Dudley bowed his head to pray.
So maybe your rational strategy is to stop undermining my faith.
On day 18 in the camp, the 33rd day after the arrival, the last of the 14,000 men arrived at Camp Septic, and we finally saw an alien ship. It was a small one, a metal sphere 150 yards in diameter, descending slowly toward us. I wondered what was holding it up, until I realized we were holding it up. The grass flattened, the tents drooped, and we all felt like we had gained 100 pounds. Water gushed up out of a storm drain, so the weight pushing on us must have been pushing even harder below ground. The ship stopped 30 feet above the flattened grass. From a distance it had looked smooth, but up close the surface was crisscrossed by weld and rivet lines, and adjacent plates were slightly different colors. One 4-foot panel seemed to be attached with green tape, which was peeling. This sight made me feel that life in Camp Septic was not so unbearable as I'd thought, so instead of boarding the ship, I should stay here a while longer. For example, my tent offered an excellent view of the Washington Monument and was only 300 yards from the porta potties. At the bottom of the sphere, the point closest to the ground, a 10-foot square panel cracked loose with a squeak, uncovering a square hole that glowed with a mysterious inner light. Truthfully, the hole glowed with ordinary light, but I was almost certain it contained something mysterious. The square panel whirred down, suspended by cables on the four corners, until it halted 2 feet above the grass. Then a three-armed mechanical monkey emerged from the mysterious hole and shinnied down the closest cable. It was the size of an orangutan, with short legs and three long arms designed for climbing, except its neck was 2 feet long and moved like an elephant's trunk. The head sported two lenses plus some metal plates I assumed were antennae. The three-armed monkey just stood there looking at me. I debated mooning it, but press cameras had to be watching, and I'd already overworked the butt theme. I could just imagine some witty reporter putting together a montage of me pulling down my pants 20 times. Finally, the robot monkey spoke.
"What are you waiting for?"
I turned around to see if he was talking to someone behind me. "Nope." I pointed to my chest. "Me?" The monkey waved his third arm impatiently.
"You can't possibly be enjoying your porta-potty lifestyle, so come aboard."
I climbed up onto the elevator deck. "You're a machine. How do you know what we enjoy?"
"Well, duh. We understand humans way better than you understand yourselves."
I thought about that. Then I shoved the robot monkey off the elevator. He fell the 2 feet to the ground, picking up extra speed from the ship gravity pressing on us, and landed on his back with a clatter. I stood on the edge of the platform. "If you understand me so well, why didn't you see that coming?"
"Hey, be nice. I'm just a kid."
Ah, he was young. I said, "Nice voice."
"Thanks. I picked it myself."
The monkey climbed to his feet and hopped nimbly up onto the elevator.
"Human psychology is like a bowling ball. It's not complicated, but you can't see it clearly if you are inside it."
While I was processing that, his third arm punched me in the eye and he said,
"See? I knew you wouldn't see that coming."
So I charged him and we wrestled. I managed to twist him into an armbar and learned his elbows bent both ways, which made an armbar stupid. A headlock worked better, but his neck was 2 feet long, so he had room to punch me with all five limbs. A crowd of men had gathered to watch us fight. I was sure I saw some of them betting rolls of toilet paper. In Camp Septic, the government had finally created an ideal paper currency, toilet paper. It was ideal because we couldn't print more of it, and it was 100% backed by our most precious, scarce resource, toilet paper. Eventually, I realized the monkey was going easy on me. Then fighting wasn't fun anymore, so we quit. One of the betting men called me a female body part, and I know it was a part he loved. The monkey extended a mechanical claw, and we shook hands in the traditional male post-fight ritual, non-alcoholic version.
So, are you willing to be my Judas goat, to lead the other humans into the ship?
I stepped back and folded my arms. I would have kicked him off the platform, like that scene in 300, but that would be dishonorable within 5 minutes of the post-fight ritual.
We're taking you to meet the women.
I couldn't believe all 14,000 of us fit into that one ship until I did the math and realized a 150-yard sphere holds 1.8 million cubic yards. That was enough space to give each of us a 15-foot cube. But before I left Camp Septic, I had to finish one last chore. When I come back in 30 minutes, will you let me cut in line and board immediately?
Sure, no problem,
he said casually. And I believed him, because I didn't know that monkey bastard had lied about taking us to the women. I used the time to visit the food services administrator, a harried but cheerful woman. She was the highest-ranking camp staffer I could reach, so she got my best prank. She was not surprised to see me in her office, nor was she surprised when I punched the side of her head so hard I knocked her out of her chair. She skipped right over the surprised part to the unconscious part. When men lose a war, they get killed. When women lose a war, they get raped. I glanced around the office and saw she had hung a sign on the wall. A woman's place is everywhere. She obviously wanted to play by men's rules, so I grabbed a pair of scissors from her desk and shoved them into her heart. Her staffers were probably surprised to find her corpse. Statistically, libertarians are the most peaceful male demographic, but I don't trust statistics. The government could have paid us to volunteer. Plenty of people would accept alien slavery in return for $10 million to their family. But then the president wouldn't get to choose who would be exempted. Billions of dollars must have changed hands to ensure no well-connected kids ended up in Camp Septic, and this bitch had helped operate that machine. She did it for money, and then she imagined I was her friend. I was tempted to lurk in her office and kill her next three visitors, but I wasn't sure I could do it silently, so I trotted back to the three-armed monkey and hopped onto the elevator to start my new life.